Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
And we are doing a special edition of Pod Save the World for very horrible reasons. The Russian opposition leader and anti-corruption activist, Alexei Navalny, has been announced dead at the age of 47. So very, very terrible. Ben, who folks on YouTube will see, is actually calling in from the Munich Security Conference, the beating heart of the blob, Ben. How's it going out there?
Yeah, it's I saw like 900 people that you know, Tommy. But like, let's say it's a jam-packed event here. But I will say, like, in a somber thing, I mean, Yulia Navalny is here, his wife. Yeah. And so, and actually, for people who listen to Another Russia, Zhanna Nemtsova, whose father, Boris Nemtsov, was also assassinated by Vladimir Putin, she's here as well. And so, you know, that kind of added this poignancy to a conference. Otherwise, it was a lot of people being like anxious about, you know, Ukraine funding and American politics. Like it just kind of drove home that these are really big stakes in the world.
Yeah, well said. I mean, yeah, we'll listen to a clip of Yulia Navalny later. And I do think, I mean, the fact that this, you know, there's debates happening in Congress over Ukraine funding, there's the Munich Security Conference happening right now, it just makes the timing of this so weird and poignant. And we'll get into that as well. But I mean, just the facts at the top here. So Alexei Navalny died while serving out a combined 30-year prison sentence. Most recently, he was at a penal colony in the Arctic Circle. That's how far away from, you know, Moscow Putin needed to send him. The Russian Federal Penitentiary Service announced his death in a statement on Friday. Basically, they said he fell and felt unwell after a walk. Apparently, Russian state media is now saying it was a blood clot. We are obviously skeptical of any explanations about his death, given the history there. Peskov, Putin's spokesman, says Putin was informed. So Navalny's team says they don't have any confirmation about his death. Navalny's lawyer is traveling to this penal colony in the Arctic Circle. But Russian media says Alexei Navalny's mother said he looked happy and healthy when she saw him on Monday. Navalny addressed a Russian court via video conference on Thursday. He looked fine. He was cracking jokes. So this is all incredibly suspicious. We do know, Ben, that his terms of his confinement were awful. I mean, I heard an interview with Navalny's daughter last year where she said her dad was spending most of his time in solitary confinement. This guy was 6'3" and his cell was 7 feet by 8 feet. He was allowed like one mug, one toothbrush, and one book. So horrible circumstances. But we'll get into more about sort of who Navalny is, like his background and his biography. But I just want to throw it to you, Ben, because, you know, I know you spent some time with Alexei Navalny for your book. You knew him as a person and also as an activist. And just wanted to, you know, hear from you, like, reflections of that relationship and also what else folks need to know about him.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, we should just say that we won't necessarily ever know the exact circumstance, but Vladimir Putin killed Alexei Navalny.
Yes. You
know? And
yes.
Whether he killed him by poisoning him yesterday or whether he killed him by all the times he's poisoned him before and the confinement, either way, Vladimir Putin killed Alexei Navalny. And that's full stop. Yeah, we can get into the kind of different nuances and complexity of Navalny. I got to know him a bit. You know, I don't know him as well as a lot of people, obviously, so I don't overstate it, but I got to know him a bit, like FaceTiming during the pandemic when I was writing my book about the rise of authoritarianism. Who better to talk to than Alexei Navalny?
Right, yeah.
And just to give you a few glimpses of character again before we necessarily get into his politics, like, first thing he does when he gets on the phone with me is he makes a joke about me. He's like, oh, you here to tell me how to do color revolution, American, you know? And he was making fun of the fact that, like, Americans think we know how to, like, promote democracy, and that ends up freaking creating problems for people like Alexei Navalny, you know? And then the second thing he did is he made fun of me for, you know, close listeners of this podcast may know I was once spied on by Black Cube, which is a bunch of, like, ex-Mossad people that dig up dirt on you and stuff. And that's the second thing he said. He's like, you know, you and me have something in common. I've been spied on by Black Cube, too. Big oligarch, you know, give Putin a birthday present, hired Black Cube to dig up all this dirt on me. And I was like, look, guy, the FSB, they have all the dirt. Like, you don't need to hire these guys, you know, like,
right. And so he had this, like, B team.
He had this incredibly, like, just direct and very Russian like sense of humor, you know, like dark but like hilarious.
And he was able to hold on to it in the darkest of circumstances, like literally like video conferencing, knowing you're to spend 30 years of your life in a penal colony if you didn't die first. He's like cracking jokes as he's zooming into a courtroom. And it was like an amazing part of his personality that he was able to, you know, keep that up throughout, you know, all that happened to him.
It was, you know, and that's exactly right. Like, it was central to his ability to go on that he could, like, make fun of this. And again, I think that is a Russian thing. And then the other personal thing I'd say, you know, he said to me, you know, I got to the point of, like, you know, you go through someone's journey and how do they get into politics? And his story is pretty interesting. Anti-corruption activist turned blogger, essentially, turned investigative journalist exposing all this corruption. But then he gets into politics. And I never really wanted to ask these questions about what's it like to be in prison, and you feel almost salacious, you know, like what's, mm-hmm. are you scared when you go to jail kind of stuff? And what if he kills you, you know, like, cause all these questions lurk in the backdrop. And he said to me, you know, of course, you're afraid when you're in prison. And I'll never forget, he said, like, when the prison door clangs shut, you know, they can do anything to you. And this is really Russia. This is, you know, like
ominous.
And when he'd said that to me, he'd already been poisoned in prison once. And he said the things that sustained him and the reason he kept coming back at it is number one, he had the support of his family. And he was very clear. He's like, if my wife, Yulia, didn't support this, I wouldn't do it. This is something we do together. He's like, I don't feel alone in prison because I feel like she's there with me because I know she supports my decision to be doing this, which I always thought was an interesting, you know, window into, like, you know, activists, not their families sacrifice for them. They have two children. Yeah.
But one also Stanford, I think, right?
Yeah. One is at Stanford, Dasha, but also that's what he's thinking about in prison. Like, you know, I take comfort in that. And you'll notice if you know, when he was in prison, he would often, you know, his messages were to his wife. But then the other thing he said is what sustained him is rage. And he said, if I ever need an incentive to be in prison, I'll just think about what it's like to be in a Russian court and the lies that they tell you. Or I'll think about, you know, the buildings that were knocked down in Moscow by a bunch of gangsters, like stealing money from people when he got into politics. Or I'll think about the lies that Putin tells why he steals, you know, rage, this weird mixture of rage, humor, and family. like that's the Alexei Navalny that I met. And it was this kind of very interesting character. And he had this way to cut through bullshit. He's like, you know, the couple of things that I always remember, like the thing that stands out to me, he said, you know, Putin doesn't need to convince everybody that he's not a liar or that he's not corrupt. He just has to convince people that everybody is, you know?
Right.
And he said the same thing is true about global politics. He's like, he has to just convince people that democracy is just as corrupt as the system in Russia. And I remember him saying to me, and look what had happened when Donald Trump gets elected. He said, my whole life I've been making an argument that in a democracy, the better people rise to the top than our system. And then all of a sudden you guys elect someone who's totally corrupt. And he was like joking about it, you know? But like, he had this kind of the way to cut through the bullshit in his analysis of Russian politics. And again, last thing, and I'll shut up. I remember him saying to me, like, I said, well, what would happen if you could run? And he said, the first time I run for president, if they really let me, I'd lose. The second time I'd win. Like, he was sure he could win, that he could be president of Russia. Like, he was certain of it. There was this kind of fearlessness and certainty of it. And again, I think that's what scared Putin. You know, like that this guy was not afraid of him. He was fucking fearless. Unlike Putin, who's like a, you know, pussy who like hides in like the Kremlin and orders these things and you know, steals money from people. And you know, it's just a tragedy like that someone like that is lost for having guts, you know?
Yeah.
You know? But he knew what he was doing when he flew back to Russia after they almost killed him last time.
Yeah. I mean, so just a little more of his backstory. I mean, I think Navalny got into politics around 2008. He became very well known internationally around the 2011 anti-government, anti-Putin protests. And then he did attempt to run for president in 2018. But to your point, Putin was so scared of him that he barred him for doing so based on some trumped up corruption charges from several years earlier. Navalny was, you're right, I mean, he was an activist. He was an opposition candidate. But he was also an incredibly powerful messenger and propagandist, really. And I say that as in the most complimentary way. His organization would make these YouTube videos about the lavish lifestyles of Putin or Dmitry Medvedev, like Putin's inner circle. And the way they were living in, literally in Putin's case, a $1 billion home paid for by corruption. I think the video about Putin's $1 billion palace in the Black Sea has over 120 million views at this point. So you can tell why Putin saw him as a threat. And, you know, to your point, like, he was poisoned in prison. And then he was poisoned again in 2020 by some FSB agents who followed him on a business trip to Siberia, poisoned his underwear, and miraculously Navalny survived that, got treatment in Germany, and then came back to Russia knowing full well he'd be arrested and thrown in jail like this. And in the process, he was so smart that he worked with this organization, Bellingcat, which figured out which FSB unit was the one who tried to assassinate him. He called one of the guys who was part of the assassination team, pretended to be his boss's boss's boss, and got him to detail to Navalny all the ways this assassination team tried to kill him, tried to cover it up, et cetera, et cetera. So just like an unbelievably savvy, creative guy. And to your point, Ben, like, the kind of like wry humor of it all was the through line through everything he did.
Yeah. I mean, there was a cleverness, right? Like, he told me the story of like how he rose from being this kind of local political operative to being this blogger. And he had a law degree, he had a legal background. And what he did is he bought a really small number of shares in like all the big Russian oil companies. And this is a little bit a while ago when there's a little bit more of a legal, and he used that to sue all of them to reveal like their schemes, you know, and so he realized that there was this tool he could use to show that they were the profits they were making, you know, didn't match up, you know, like basically he was revealing that they were,
right, he got their financial statements.
There are billions of dollars disappearing to middlemen. And I tell that story because like, he was always kind of one step ahead in being clever about finding a weakness in the regime. And it was always about corruption. It was always about exposing corruption. And he was sometimes criticized for being a single issue guy who just focused on corruption. But, you know, what he would always say is, well, the whole thing is corrupt. So if we don't get rid of this corrupt system, we can't solve the other problems. Like, I'd love to have an agenda about like healthcare and, you know, foreign policy. But before that, we have to get rid of these corrupt kleptocrats, essentially, you know? And again, that built this following that he had across Russia. And it should be clear, like, I've admired Boris Nemtsov, for instance, the politician I mentioned who was assassinated. Navalny was not like a Western liberal. Like, you know, he wasn't one of these Russian opposition guys that hangs out a lot in Washington. And I admire those guys, by the way. I don't mean to mean them. But he was like a pretty hard-ass guy from a military town outside of Moscow. He associated with some Russian nationalists, which we'll probably talk about. But he also, he reached different audiences. It wasn't like he was just reaching, some of it was kind of like these middle-class Muscovites who turned up to protest when Putin came back into office when Navalny led that protest movement. But, you know, he could also reach into other parts of Russia, and he traveled all across the country. Like, when he was poisoned, he was in Siberia, you know? And so this combination of innovation and humor and also just kind of being, you know, a pretty authentic Russian guy with a very authentic Russian family, again, that all contributed to the kind of potency of his standing.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that nationalism was part of his appeal, part of his ability to reach beyond, as you said, kind of like elite educated circles in Moscow and to sort of like appeal to the common man. To your point about his divisiveness in some circles, I mean, I think he was seen as a divisive figure among some of the more liberal opposition in Russia because they thought he was more of an attention getter than a politician. Like you said earlier, I mean, Navalny admitted he didn't really have policy proposals. He did these, you know, anti-corruption YouTube videos that garnered lots of attention and sort of went after Putin. But that was what he saw as his path to taking down this corrupt regime. There was also some controversy around Navalny in 2021. Amnesty International briefly revoked Navalny's prisoner of conscience status after some of his old comments resurfaced, including a time when he compared immigrants to cockroaches. Obviously, that's like a totally inappropriate, dehumanizing thing to say. But, you know, I think it did sort of speak to the kind of person that Putin saw as a threat and who could appeal politically to Putin voters, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, you know, he's been asked about this a lot, and actually people should watch the documentary Navalny, and he's asked about this there, and he gives like a pretty clear answer. Some of that stuff he's apologized for, like he ended up apologizing for. And, you know, I think he like was a bit more of like a, you know, some of the rough edges may have been smoothed over, but he defended some of his association with these kind of ultra-nationalist dudes. And he makes this point in the documentary, and people can judge for themselves. He's like, I'm trying to like get rid of this autocrat. Like, I, yep. Anybody that's against Putin, you know,
right.
And we can debate that, but put yourself in his shoes, you know, like by and large, like the people around Navalny were more liberal, you know, folks who wanted to have democratic values. I think that, you know, in my conversation with Navalny, he just basically talked about, you know, Putin represents not just corruption, but also this kind of Russian czar mindset where we spend money on wars and, instead of spending, you know, his message to me, Tommy, was basically like, let's stop spending message on wars overseas and start investing money in Russia. You know, let's stop like giving money
it's
to the kleptocrats.
John Kerry in 2004.
Yeah, it's a pretty classic like populist message.
Yep.
Like democratic principles, bring the money home. I don't think he was like some uber nationalist. Even on Ukraine, and I write about this a lot in the book, like, you know, was he supported the annexation of Crimea. Mm-hmm. Now, what he explained to me, his family was half Ukrainian, half Russian, right? One of his parents was Russian, one of his parents was Ukrainian. And he said they used to fight about this all the time. And, you know, his version was like, we should leave Ukraine the hell alone, but give us Crimea, you know? Now, I want to be clear about one thing, though, on this. He would not have annexed Crimea, though. You know, he would not have invaded Crimea. He would not have invaded... This, you know, these are positions he took after the war started. And he was an anti-war, like he in prison when he could get him killed, he was protesting the war. And his whole message to me was what a waste war is and we shouldn't be doing it. So I think that we shouldn't whitewash the nationalism, but that doesn't make him Putin. I know some people are like, oh, yeah. What's the difference? You know,
just put it in context.
There's a massive fucking difference. This guy would not have invaded Ukraine. This guy would not be killing people like him in Russia. This guy would not be like stealing hundreds of billions of dollars and giving it to people with yachts, you know, like, and so I think that's the kind of, you know, you can't avoid, you know, some of the nationalism in his background and the associations, but you also have to see it in the context of Russia. And I'd put this to people, Russia's not going away. It's a huge, important country. Would you rather have like a guy like Alexei Navalny running the place or Vladimir Putin? You know?
Yeah. I mean, look, we're trying to build a coalition over here from like Bill Kristol to Bernie Sanders. So we have a piece of that for coming from our own house here. So Ben, you mentioned that Yulia Navalny, Alexei Navalny's wife, was at the Munich Security Conference when she heard the news. She actually addressed the group on the main stage. Here's a clip.
If this is true, I would like that Putin and all his coterie, Putin's friends, his government, to know that they will be accountable for what they've done to our country, to my family, and to my husband. They will be liable for that. That day will come very soon. I would like to call upon the global community, everyone in this room, people around the world, so that we would unite together and overcome that evil, overcome the terrible regime that is currently in Russia.
We should just say, Ben, that, you know, when Vladimir Putin had his FSB guys try to assassinate Navalny in 2020, he was asked about it at his like yearly press conference. And he didn't. He said, yes, basically, he admitted that the FSB had been tailing Navalny. But basically, his response was like, look, if we wanted to kill them, they would have finished the job. So, you know, he is this behavior has been approached with complete impunity by Putin. We'll get into this more with the Biden press conference clips later, but I'm sure there will be efforts by, you know, Western countries to punish Putin and punish Russia for this act. But, you know, if Biden gets into this a bit, I mean, a lot of those steps have already been taken in terms of sanctions, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, it's just like, I don't know, I got a little emotional hearing that because it's just, you know, you have to, you're right. Like, this is, like, we're not going to, like, sanction Putin to, you know, like, to surrender over the Navalny thing. And, you know, we're not going to go to war with Russia over this, right? And so at the end of the day, and even the war in Ukraine, like we talked about, is you know, there's a stalemate there. But the question that she raises about accountability, right, is a historical question. You know, it's basically like 20 years from now, Vladimir Putin could die in his bed, president of Russia, richest man in the world, right? Or, like, one way or another, he will have been, like, hoisted out of there, and it will be in disgrace, you know? That's the real accountability. It's not some sanction we put on them, you know? And I think the basic message from the Navalny family is, like, if more people had the guts of Alexei Navalny, like, in every dimension, we don't all have to end up in a Siberian prison. I'm not suggesting we all go to Siberia and get thrown in prison and killed. But this guy, like, the example of him flying back to Russia after he was poisoned.
It's astounding.
Knowing he'd get arrested when he landed there.
Yeah.
And knowing he'd probably get killed in prison after suffering a lot. Like, think about the kind of asks that we make of ourselves, you know, like, can you volunteer for a campaign or something, you know, it's just like if a few more people, or like, you know, some fucking Republicans who are afraid to like break with Trump on Ukraine supplemental because
like
they don't get
Graham.
Like fucking Truth Social at them, or, you know, or some Russians, by the way, like a bunch of Russian oligarchs who, yeah, like don't want to give up their yachts so they don't want to cross Putin. Like, well, this guy gave up his life, okay? Roman Abramovich. Like, that's the lesson for me from all this is, like, if you want to step way, way back, this guy was willing to die for his belief that Vladimir Putin is, like, a kleptocratic criminal who is, like, ruining his country. And we can all do a little bit better. And if we do, it's more likely that in the whole, not just in the war in Ukraine, but in the kind of whole contest that is happening, it's more likely than not that he will not die in his bed, the richest man in the world and the ruler of Russia.
You know, so Ben, I think, you know, it just listeners should know that the space for journalism and opposition leaders and critics of Putin was very small before the invasion of Ukraine. And now it's, you know, completely shrunk, if not gone. It is worth also pointing out that Putin was scared of Navalny. I mean, he wouldn't even use his name. But now Putin has thrown in jail or killed or forced into exile basically every prominent Russian opposition leader. He's actually targeting Navalny's team as well. They labeled his organization an extremist organization. They've been cracking down on Navalny's defense attorneys. you know, you went through some of this earlier, but, you know, Boris Nemtsov was murdered in 2015. The former oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky has been funding opposition leaders, but he's doing it from exile. So, you know, like there is just the question of kind of what comes next and who could take up the mantle of an Alexei Navalny is a very hard one because there's not any obvious answer at the moment.
Yeah, I'm going to be clear. Like, I actually don't put it on, like, you know, some 20-year-old Russian to, when I say people need to do more and be better. Like, I get why, like, some young Russian isn't, like, rushing into the street to just get arrested and thrown in prison. But that doesn't mean that there's not things that can be done within Russian society. And that doesn't mean that there aren't things that can be done, like, these Russian elites who've, you know, made a deal with, like, Putin, like the Republicans made with Trump, like, you know, 20 years ago, they made that deal. And some of those people have resources and they could be doing things. I think the Russian diaspora that has left, like, can stay politically active. I think, by the way, that, you know, not that, again, be very clear, these are not U.S. The Navalny movement is very much a Russian movement. So we have to be careful not to turn it into some Western-backed movement. But we can support them. We can, you know, they, I'll give you one example, Tommy. Like, they were setting up their whole YouTube channels and their whole kind of capacity to broadcast when they were exiled. And they were having trouble getting on American tech platforms because of sanctions, mm-hmm. you know. And, well, we can find a solution to that. Like, yeah. The government can sit down with the tech companies. Like, these kind, there are things that can be done to make it easier for a Russian opposition by both by Russians and by outsiders. But there's not another leader of his stature. There's not. Like, you know, Nemtsov was a popular leader, not as popular even as Navalny by the end, because for a lot of reasons. And, you know, which we go into in another Russia, the podcast that I did, but like, with Zhanna, his daughter. But the, Navalny was like a big, you know, the biggest figure by far in the Russian opposition. But I don't know. I think he knew what he was doing. And I think he knew that, like, if he was killed, if he survived, then he could become president. And if he didn't, I think he probably knew that that would, like, instill in a lot of Russians a sense of, like, this is fucked.
I mean, it's martyrdom. And I mean, like, it's an incredibly powerful thing.
And when the moment comes, and it's come in Russia, man. It came in 1905. It came in 1917. Like, when the moment comes, people will be fucking pissed because of what he did to Alexei Navalny. And there'll be somebody else who was inspired by him who will become that leader, you know? And meanwhile, he's got an infrastructure that can keep working on this. And I think, you know, so it's less like having one person to be the focal point and more just like what he represents won't die with him.
Yeah, well said. So President Biden came out pretty quickly to give a statement about Alexei Navalny, and he took some questions from press. Let's hear an excerpt.
Reports of his death, if they're true, and I have no reason to believe they're not, Russian authorities are going to tell their own story. But make no mistake, Putin is responsible for Navalny's death. Putin is responsible. What has happened to Navalny is yet more proof of Putin's brutality. No one should be fooled, not in Russia, not at home, not anywhere in the world. Putin does not only target his citizens of other countries, as we've seen what's going on in Ukraine right now. He also inflicts terrible crimes on his own people. And as people across Russia and around the world are mourning Navalny today, because he was so many things that Putin was not. He was brave. He was principled. He was dedicated to building a Russia where the rule of law existed and where it applied to everybody. Navalny believed in that Russia, that Russia. He knew it was the cause worth fighting for and obviously even dying for. This tragedy reminds us of the stakes of this moment.
You know, Ben, I know you haven't had time to watch the whole thing yet because you're in Munich, but it's a very strong statement from Biden. I mean, clearly something, an issue he knows about and is passionate about and someone he's probably spent time with. Biden was also asked directly if the United States views this as an assassination.
Sir, first, was this an assassination?
The answer is that we don't know exactly what happened, but there is no doubt that the death of Navalny was the consequence of something that Putin and his thugs did.
And to be clear, you warned Vladimir Putin when you were in Geneva of devastating consequences if Navalny died in Russian custody. What consequences should he and Russia face?
That was 3 years ago. In the meantime, they faced a hell of a lot of consequences. They've lost and or had wounded over 350,000 Russian soldiers. They've made them a position where they've been subjected to great sanctions across the board, and we're contemplating what else could be done. But what we were talking about at the time, there were no actions being taken against Russia. And that, look, all has transpired since then.
So, Ben, I mean, I thought it was a strong statement. I'm glad Biden came out and took this head on the day it happened. I think that answer there, that, yeah, you know, you're right. Like, we may never know exactly what happened to Alexei Navalny, but there is no doubt that this is Vladimir Putin's fault that you know, led him to die at age 47. He's not an old man who's just going to drop dead. And also, you know, I think Biden was kind of trying to temper expectations there by being honest that there's just not a ton more diplomatically that the U.S. can do.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the fact that he gave this statement, you know, if there's the U.S. probably follows this pretty closely, it kind of indicates to me that he's dead. You know, like this idea of like, we're not sure, like, I don't think he would have gone out.
I don't either.
You know, maybe I'm wrong about that, but, you know, they probably know. And I think he was right to put the responsibility on Putin. And I think the thing I'd say, Tommy, because this whole thing has got me a little reflective and, you know, it's late at night in Munich and I've been pretty hard on Joe Biden, like, of late, you know, on Gaza. And obviously we're going through the whole stuff about, you know, his age and, you know, people right. want, but you know what, like, do you want a president? What would Donald Trump say? Like, Donald Trump, like, is talking about, like, you know, telling Russia to do whatever the hell it wants.
He didn't care in 2020. Like,
Donald Trump doesn't give a shit about Alexei Navalny. No. This is not a joke, people. This is where it ends. Like, Putin got elected in 2000, and, you know, it was a 24-year journey to, like, people getting killed in prison like this. Like, I don't want to take that chance.
No.
And so, again, like, I actually thought about this today. It's like, you know, this should drive home the consequences for people. You may not love Joe Biden. Like, you may have some issues with this policy or... But, like, this is not something to fuck around with, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, this is where it ends. This is where this kind of autocracy ends. Like, Vladimir Putin sitting in the Kremlin, invading countries and killing people. Like, that's where autocracy ends. And that's what Trump represents, you know? And like, that was, I sent you, Tommy, the last exchange I had with Navalny was on text was about these people are all the same, you know? And again, I'm sure Trump hasn't done the things Putin's done. I'm not suggesting the direct equivalence. But this is not something to mess around with. Right. And I think, you know, that's something we should remember today.
Yeah, listen, Trump is on the side of the oligarchs, not the people fighting them. He is on the side of the authoritarians, not the people fighting them. You would like, Ben, in this speech, Biden hit Congress hard for going on vacation for 2 weeks. I didn't realize this. Congress is in recess for 2 weeks without, you know, passing Ukraine funding. They're just letting it dangle out there. Biden also used this as an opportunity to go hard after Trump's comments today about, you know, telling Putin that he should invade a NATO country that hadn't spent 2% of GDP on defense. So it was really strong overall. You got asked about the anti-satellite capability stories that popped up earlier this week. By the way, if folks want to learn more about that, we did a YouTube exclusive Pod Save the World interview with an expert named James Acton that's on our Pod Save the World YouTube channel. But yeah, I'm with you, Ben. Like, listen, I've been frustrated with Biden on Gaza. I think almost everybody would agree that he did an incredible job rallying the world in support of Ukraine and deserves a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. And just as a general matter, we should be on the right side of these things.
Yep,
you know?
Yep.
And these are huge fault lines. And, you know, like, the bottom line is are you on the right side of this thing? And the fact that these people are hiding. I mean, I'm in Munich, Tommy, and, like, one of the things people are talking about is, like, Lindsey Graham used to love to come to this conference.
Yeah, he skipped
every
it, right?
year, Lindsey Graham. Yeah. He skipped it and went to the border instead, right? But the reason he skipped it is because he's afraid to look these people, not that there's such a bunch of badasses here in Munich, but he's literally afraid to look these people in the face and explain why he opposes this supplemental.
Right.
Like, these are a bunch of cowards,
he's a coward.
You know, who don't stand for anything. And the day like today exposes all of that.
Yep.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So we asked the Discord, the Pod Save the World Discord, for some questions. They sent in some great ones per usual. So Spiffy asks, I love the names on these things. Why do you think Putin decided to kill Navalny now? What does he gain from publicizing this right before his reelection? Ben, I'll admit, like, I've been wondering this too. I mean, Putin has tried to kill Navalny a couple times. He could have had him killed at any moment. It is surprising that in the middle of this big political fight in the U.S. over more Ukraine funding, that he would, and maybe it wasn't sort of directly in his control, and that's the answer. But for this to happen now seems like the kind of international news story that just might be able to shame a couple Republicans into finding a backbone and breaking with Donald Trump and supporting Ukraine aid. I mean, it seems like the most disadvantageous political moment for Putin to do this.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's certainly possible that, you know, Navalny's just been so poisoned over time and grinded down that he did have like a blood clot or something, you know, that, again, Putin's still responsible because this man has been pumped with poison and treated like in torture conditions. If he was killed because of timing, which we don't know and probably never will, you know, I think in general, Putin seems to be feeling pretty full of himself right now, and he's kind of rubbing everybody's face in it. You know, the Tucker Carlson interview, and he's trying to show people in general that he is winning and he's going to do whatever he wants. This Munich Security Conference, by the way, which we can make fun of because it is kind of like a, you know, blob reunion, but like he had like a weird fixation on that. Like he came here and gave a speech once about, you know, telling everybody to, you know, where to put it. So maybe it's that. I don't know. What I would say is, as a general matter, the message emanating from Putin and the Kremlin is, I really don't care. I don't care about your sanctions. I don't care about all the aid you've given Ukraine. I don't even care about the hundreds of thousands of Russians who've been killed and wounded here. Like, I'm just going to keep being Putin. And, you know, that's something we need to factor in.
Yeah. Hey, congrats again, Tucker Carlson, on your hard-hitting interview where you just were with...
Who didn't ask about Navalny, by the way.
Sure didn't.
Did not ask about Navalny.
Sure didn't. So two Discord members, Miles and Zach, have similar questions about, you know, whether there's anyone in the Russian opposition that could take up the Navalny mantle and sort of lead an opposition party. Ben, it's worth pointing out that there is an opposition figure named Boris Nadirjin who was just barred from running. He tried to challenge that ruling, and just yesterday his challenge was rejected. Nadirjin isn't a true opposition figure the way Navalny is. He more worked within the system, but he did take an anti-war stance. I suspect it was popular in a lot of quarters, especially with people who are sick of seeing their, you know, sons and friends killed in this meaningless war. But, you know, to our point earlier, it's not obvious who or how you could lead an opposition movement at this moment.
Yeah, there's just not. I mean, and he even said, the guy who was disqualified in his interviews, he's like, I'm not as charismatic or popular as Alexei Navalny, but, you know, someone's got to run you. That was basically his message. And it's just, you know, there are a bunch of people in prison. There are a bunch of people out of the country. Nobody of this stature. There's some movements, the infrastructure, what happens to the infrastructure Navalny built will be interesting. Like, I hope it continues because it does this service of exposing corruption. But again, I think ultimately, you don't know where it's going to come from. I mean, is it some soldier who returns home who's pissed off about what he was made to do in Ukraine? Is it someone out of the country that organizes? It's probably not the worst thing that, you know, it's going to have to kind of organically generate instead of it just being hung on one person. But there's really not. There's not like some next in line here, I think, to be at the front of the Russian opposition. You know, then there are these people like Khodorkovsky and Garry Kasparov, these people out of the country, but they're not as tied in to, you know, what's, you know, Navalny had his finger pretty close to the pulse there.
Yeah.
And so even the prominent exiles, I don't think they have that standing.
Yeah, if you're spending more time in like Brookings than like, you know, farms in Siberia, yeah, you're probably don't quite have your finger on the pulse. I mean, it also is interesting, Ben, that we're about to be at the 2-year anniversary of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. I say full-scale because Ukrainians will always remind you that the Russians started invading Ukraine in 2014 with Crimea and then the Donbass, et cetera. But a couple folks asked, you know, do you think Congress will see this as incentive to continue supporting Ukraine? Do you think any Republicans will kind of back off their pro-Putin, pro-autocrat rhetoric as public outrage grows over his death? That's a really great question of sort of how this will break politically, Ben, because, you know, again, Navalny was poisoned in 2020 when Trump was in charge. I think he viewed kind of any debate about whether or not he should be critical of Putin as an affront to him personally in some sort of tacit, you know, suggestion that he got help in the election or whatever. It's just like it all got tied up in his narcissism. But I mean, I'm curious what your take is on whether this is the kind of thing that could break through politically.
Oh man, I wish it were, but I don't think so, right? You know, I mean, and you probably have a better sense of this than me, Tommy. Like it feels like the reasons, you know, it's appealing to the conscience of these Republicans. Where has that kind of gotten us? I mean, I do think what it will do, I think, is energize. It might energize Europe a little bit more. I mean, it kind of just reinforces the depths of what we're dealing with in Putin. Mm-hmm. And so I think it can only help, you know, in terms of like what more support can be provided by Europe, what more, you know, can we get some more people in Congress to the people that are invested in the supplemental maybe will feel energized to put more pressure on people, you know? I just don't know whether it's going to move like a callous, self-interested, scared politician like Lindsey Graham.
Yeah. So Ilona just sent around to our Slack Speaker Johnson's statement on Navalny's death. I'll skip the first two paragraphs, which are not totally germane to this, but it said that he says, in the coming days, as international leaders are meeting in Munich, we must be clear that Putin will be met with united opposition as Congress debates the best path forward to support Ukraine, comma. The United States and our partners must be using every means available to cut off Putin's ability to fund his unprovoked war in Ukraine and aggression against the Baltic states. So, I mean, at face value, you read that and think like, okay, so you're going to put the thing on the floor and vote on it, right? But I still worry this coward thinks he's going to lose his speakership if he supports Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. Like, I hope I'm wrong. And like, you know, there's a big rally and like a Navalny effect. And what's so crazy about that statement is it kind of seems to allude to sanctions. Like, the sanctions they're not working, people. Like, I hate to tell you, like, they work a bit, you know, like they took some money away from the Russian government and the Russian oligarchs, but they have all these workarounds. And so that's like a, you know, sitting in Washington, you know, demanding more sanctions. That's not going to be the thing that works here, you know? So that feels like the fact that he didn't direct it to and we're going to pass funding to support Ukraine, but he directed it to kind of holding them accountable and blah, blah, blah. Like, again, I hope that it means that they'll act, but I'm not that.
Yeah,
optimistic.
I'm with you there. Final question is from Exploding Gopher, maybe a Minnesotan, hopefully.
That's good. Or Caddyshack.
Or Caddyshack, even better. Will the U.S. have any response other than Biden making a statement? What can the U.S. or the international community do? I mean, I think the debate we're talking about right now over Ukraine funding in Congress is obviously the most important thing. I do think your point is well taken, Ben, that this could motivate or inspire folks in European capitals to dig deeper and do more. I mean, look, rhetorical, Biden's statement rhetorically was great. Maybe he'll give a big speech about democracy versus autocracy. Maybe he'll make it part of the State of the Union, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. You could imagine a big Navalny section there and a messaging effort around it. Clearly, they, the White House, think this fight over NATO with Trump is politically advantageous for them. But I don't know. I mean, you could also imagine a scenario where Trump just fucking tweets something terrible and steps in it and creates problems for himself. So.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's, in addition to the things we talked about, right, like there's Ukraine support, there's potentially the kinds of support for the Russian opposition that not to co-opt them, but to just kind of like help them platform. But then there's like, you know, the kind of stuff Navalny did, like revealing corruption, you know. I always thought the U.S. government could do more.
Yeah.
Like, why couldn't the U.S. government make the video about Putin's house?
That's a good point.
Like in a weird way, we can learn from Navalny and like, you know, this, if Putin feels so vulnerable by this stuff, like, well, why aren't we doing it, you know, and not in like a covert way, like in an, like, why not just say like, you know what, like you have, we know this about you guys and you have a right to know about it, you know? So that's another thing. You can also not let the memory die. Like Putin's going to try to like erase this guy,
for sure.
You know, like, I think it's important to like remind people that this happened and remind people, that's why, you know, we try to remind people about like Boris Nemtsov getting killed in front of the Kremlin. I think you can demand, actually, I think it's useful to demand international investigations because they can become pains
totally.
In the ass. You know, like you open up all these investigations. This is what Zhanna Nemtsova did with her dad, like the European Court of Justice and all these other people
Interpol
are like,
notices,
you know, investigating. Yeah, for the rest of time, like there should be investigations into how Navalny died. To get at Yulia's point, so that like, you know, one day, maybe, you know, 10 years from now, actually, like, there's a bunch of people that go to prison for that. So there's stuff that can be done. We just shouldn't think that there's some lever that we can pull and change Putin right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it is.
You know. No, I think your point about emulating Navalny and his organization and using the billions and billions of dollars invested in the U.S. intelligence community to surface, you know, the next billion-dollar palace owned by Putin and, you know, release it to the world is a great idea. I mean, I think, and this is actually, you know, an area where the administration has done a lot of work, right, in advance of the Russian invasion. They were declassifying all kinds of intelligence. Jake Sullivan was talking about this from the podium a couple of days ago. They're incredibly proud of what they think is a novel and clever approach to using intelligence. I agree with them. And I think your idea is a good one and a way they could build on it. Ben, before...
And one last thing on that, Tommy, is like, a good legacy is to go after kleptocracy even harder, you know, like go after the oligarch, like give, you know, accelerate the process of giving that money to the Ukrainians, like, you know, do the things that he stood for that were right.
Yeah, paging folks in London. You know, we're looking at you there to crack down some of these kleptocrats. I did notice, Ben, that a friend of the pod, Max Seddon, great journalist who's covered Russia for a long time, said that Russians in Moscow are lining up to lay flowers in memory of Navalny at a memorial to Gulag victims outside of FSB headquarters. That's pretty brave, given, you know, the likelihood that those people will now be monitored forever or cracked down on. It sounds like police have detained several people at makeshift memorials in Moscow. Some of our people are chanting and throwing snowballs at them and shouting shame. So there are, you know, clearly in these initial hours, some Russians who are doing very brave things and who are incredibly upset and angry about, you know, this brazen assassination of a political figure.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because it'll be interesting to see what kind of protests there are. We shouldn't expect that they're going to like topple the government, but like, I think you'll see those kinds of demonstrations. And I think what we should say, Tommy, is like, yeah, look, I talked about like, you know, few communications of the guy, like this guy meant a lot to a lot of Russians.
Yeah.
And I feel really bad today for obviously first and foremost his family, but like, you know, what if you're just some young person that really looked up to the Navalny and you're living in, you know, not even Moscow, you're living, you know, in Vladivostok or wherever, how you must be feeling now. You must just feel like all is lost, you know, like that they've taken away everything now. They've taken away this guy that was the guy that made you feel strong. And again, I hope in that kind of, you know, Russian way that isn't channeled to giving up. It's kind of channeled into like, well, you know what, like, you know, we're going to remember how this feels. And when we have an opening, you know, we're going to take it, you know, but I feel bad. I just can't imagine how that feels to be like a Russian who wishes it was.
Yeah, and you know, and you're looking around you, and you know, the economy has been wrecked by the invasion of Ukraine and international sanctions. I mean, the whole economy now is basically a war economy. Every male under a certain age is being dragged into conscription from parts of the country. So yeah, I mean, I think desperate times like that, you know, oppression can lead to some incredibly brave and bold reactions, and especially when you're inspired by someone like Navalny. I think your point earlier is like, yeah, we probably shouldn't be looking to like a Garry Kasparov to and expect that type of person to lead the next revolution, right? In Tunisia, it was a fruit vendor who just felt so demoralized and disrespected by the government that he lit himself on fire, and it sparked off the entire Arab Spring. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things that no one will ever be able to predict. Not us, not the intelligence community, not anybody. It will come from some grassroots frustration.
And it won't be because of some like sanction that we get. Right. You know, like that's the thing. It'll be because of what Russia
the 400th doing. Sanction on, you know, foreign assets that no longer exist. Yeah. Well, listen, Ben, it's super late there in Munich. I'm super grateful that you are willing to get on the phone and talk now. Any final thoughts before we wrap it up?
No, I'm sorry if I'm, drone on because I was tired. I guess, you know, my last thought was it was interesting talking to Navalny in the pandemic when, you know, he was home with his family and, you know, he's about my age and this guy, like, you know, he's a charismatic guy. Mm-hmm. Like he could have moved to the West and, you know, been some celebrity exile guy. And again, that's not to criticize, you know, I think there's a very good place for celebrity exile people. He could have done all kinds of things. He, you know, it's pretty extraordinary that, you know, his decision, if you watch that Navalny documentary, it shows the flight into Moscow where he knows what's going to happen when he lands. And he's on this plane and everybody's gawking at him. And he's literally playing like Call of Duty or something. He's just clearly trying to zone out, you know. But he's looking out the window. He wanted to be in Russia. He wanted to die in Russia. And he wanted to be on Russian soil. And there's something really powerful about that. And like, that's part of Russian history too. Like a lot of people went to the gulags and, everybody did a turn in Siberia and like not everybody got out, you know. And I think we just have to remember this is not just like some icon. This is like a human being. I saw like our friend of the pod, Bobby Wine, post about this, you know, like that kind of guts gives other people courage. Yeah. And I don't think we should let the message be that it's not worth it. I think the message should be people will not ever forget that. And that other people are going to step up in their own ways and their own countries because we can't let this win. We cannot let this kind of thuggish, kleptocratic, self-interested authoritarianism that tries to grind you down and make you think that nothing matters, nothing can ever change. That's what Vladimir Putin wants you to think by killing Alexei Navalny. And I think Navalny, what he wants us to think by flying back to Russia is think that no, it can change, but only if people are willing to stand up to it. And that's what we should take.
Absolutely. And you know what, Vladimir Putin, you might have killed the guy, but you'd also immortalized him. You know, I think he's someone who's a historic figure now who will be in every history book, every textbook going forward, even if you try to erase them. You're going to die too, buddy. Well, Ben, thanks again for doing this. Very, very sad day, but good to talk with you about it. Makes me feel a little, you know, a little more hopeful.
Yeah, you too, man.
If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers and other community events, plus find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. And if you're as opinionated as us, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Reed Cherlin. Our producer is Ilona Minkowski, and associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our studio technician is David Tolles. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Phoebe Bradford, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld.